It's the Burt Cohen Show. And of course, a lot of what goes on, we like to sweep under the rug. The less pleasant things, the things we don't want to look at, we just make them invisible. One of those things is prisons. Nobody really talks about prisons, but they are a big issue. The purpose of a prison is to protect society from dangerous people and to reform and correct unacceptable behavior. But it's a very old concept, and in the 21st century, it's time to ask, do they reduce crime? Do they positively redirect those who have been in prison? The U.S. has a very high incarceration rate, the highest in the world, and recidivism is also very high. Well, in her new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, our guest is award-winning journalist Maya Shenhuar. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
And this book, Locked Down, Locked Out, looks at what she calls our prison nation, in which she says that instead of healing, incarceration is tearing society apart. It's supposed to heal society, not tear it apart. What's broken and how it can be fixed? Shenhuar is editor-in-chief at Truthout, an independent social justice news website, and has written about the prison industrial complex for The New York Times, The Guardian, and many others. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Maya Shenhuar. How did you come to write this book? And I'm sure that's an interesting story in itself.
Well, yeah. So I have been writing about prison for the past 10 years as a journalist. But what really drove me to write this book is that this topic has been also coming home to me throughout that period of time. My sister has been incarcerated on and off for the past 9 years. And so my family has really become entangled in this system and the way that it kind of gets its tentacles around anyone who comes close to it. And so throughout this time, I've witnessed my sister come out of prison and be sucked back in, at this point, 4 times, sucked back into incarceration. And this system, throughout that time, I was writing about sentencing reform. I was writing about a number of kind of small things around the edges. But the way in which she's been pulled back to prison each time has really convinced me that this is not a system that's functional, and it fundamentally is not something that can heal us.
Wow, 9 years. That's, yeah, and people pretend it doesn't exist. That's one reason, you know, we don't deal with the issues of prison. What is a common experience for people when they do become released from prison?
Well, I think on a number of levels, it's very difficult. One of those is just kind of the basics that you need to survive. You get out of prison, and especially if you're a person of color, you're going to have trouble finding a job. And that's kind of an understatement. 70% of parolees in one recent study were unemployed. And wow. It kind of is this thing in our culture that if you see on someone's job application or discover in an interview that they've been incarcerated, they automatically go to the bottom of your list. One recent parolee that I was interviewing told me he went to a car dealership. He used to be a used car dealer, actually, before he was incarcerated for 15 years on a mandatory minimum charge. And he went for this job interview recently, and he said everything was going well. he was about to get the job, and he had to disclose the fact that he was incarcerated, and he said the guy interviewing him actually started shaking. And it just kind of revealed this thing in the fabric of the process that being incarcerated kind of marks you in this way that even afterwards, if it's tough to get the things you need. Housing is another issue facing a lot of incarcerated people, and some especially like low-income housing that you have to qualify for. Some housing projects actually ban you if you've been incarcerated or if you've had certain felonies. Also, educational opportunities are more difficult to come by. So all these things are barriers. In addition to that, though, incarceration can be very traumatizing. And trauma, as you're coming out, can really be an obstacle to moving forward and living a fulfilling and happy and healthy and stable life.
And I... I was just thinking that if... You know, the idea, there's a couple of ideas, as far as I understand, of prison. One is to protect society, and the other is to rehabilitate people. And if you don't, you know, if you protect society from dangerous people for a while, and either they come out better people, or, you know, what is the point of bringing people back into society if they can't get jobs, if... You know, the recidivism rate is so high, and I'm sure, frankly, many people who don't have relatives or haven't known anybody in prison would just say, "Well, just lock them up and throw away the key." Do you find there's a lot of that feeling?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It used to be, I think, there used to be more of that sentiment.
Right.
Now, people are very conflicted because they're still scared of people with any kind of criminal record,
right.
But also state budgets are skyrocketing, and prison is proving to be very, very, very costly. So some of this tough-on-crime rhetoric mm-hmm. and that has been very pervasive in politics over the past 35 years has abated, and it's been replaced with this discussion of being kind of smart on crime, although that has its own problems, where people say, okay, we'll release people from prison if they pose no danger to society, which is basically people convicted of like drug possession, things like that, that really are like the smallest of crimes. And that's positive. That's definitely, I think, a step in the right direction if it does happen. Still a very new phenomenon. But it leaves us with this kind of lingering question of like, well, that's good, but are we then saying that prison functions in a positive way for people who have committed crimes that have harmed people, you know? And I say in my book that it doesn't function that way, that it doesn't have a healing or reforming effect. But at the same time, you know, especially given state budgets, I don't think very many people would argue for increasing everyone's sentences to the point that we'd be locking people up and throwing away the key. So it is this conundrum that we're not talking about the people in prison who are there for offenses that might be harmful, you know. And at the same time, most people who are incarcerated are not there for drug possession. So,
so are they, any clue as to how many, you know, what percentage of people there are there for, you know, real violent crimes when they have harmed society and society really does need to protect itself from these people?
You know, it is a minority of people who've actually committed very harmful, violent crimes. A minority of people in prison. And actually, I think if we had a frank discussion as a society about, okay, well, what things that people do are seriously harmful, there would really be a range. Because the word crime, the things that we define as crime, are subjective, you know. So, for example, companies severely polluting and degrading the environment, that's not considered a crime, but it's extremely harmful to society.
Good point.
Whereas, for example, heroin possession, that's a crime. You know, so I think that, like, on the one hand, we have to have a discussion of how we define crime and how we define harm. You know, if we're talking about, well, who's incarcerated for something that's actually harmed society, to me, a big question is who's not incarcerated for things that harm society. But yeah, I mean, it's a minority of people who are incarcerated for actual, like, severe violent crimes. And certainly people always bring up rape and murder.
Sure.
And there's, I think, like 5% of people who are incarcerated are there for murder. So that's a really small percentage. And certainly we have to think about, well, how are we dealing with those people and are we rehabilitating them? But I think that, like, more pressing is a sense of how are we dealing with problems that aren't murder by incarcerating people, and are there better ways that we can deal with those problems?
Interesting.
So, for example,
yeah,
theft. We incarcerate so many people for theft and burglary and robbery.
Yes.
Is that helping them? Very often they're getting out and committing more theft, burglary, and robbery.
And I've actually heard of cases where people who want to learn how to do it more effectively figure, well, the place to learn how to be a better thief is to go to jail. That you have the professionals right there. They can, you know, it can be a school. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. You're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. The book is called Locked Down, Locked Out, just coming out now, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Our guest today is author Maya Shenhwar. And as you mentioned, possession of heroin is considered a crime. And that amazes me, really. I mean, people commit crimes. They get addicted to things like OxyContin, things they're prescribed for. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, they can't get it. They're not allowed to get it, even though they are physically addicted to it. Heroin is much cheaper, so they commit crimes to get it, to get the money to pay for it. But the possession of heroin, I mean, there must be other ways of dealing with possession of heroin. Are there other ways that have been shown to deal with mere possession of heroin more effectively, like in other countries maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, decriminalizing drugs at this point is one of the first steps toward addressing incarceration as we know it. I think that the thing with drug possession is that you're incarcerating someone for an action in which they're doing something for themselves. So whether they're harming themselves, I mean, in many cases with drug possession, the person actually isn't harming themselves. They're using a drug, but they're not necessarily addicted to it or overdosing on it. But in many cases, and I think particularly with heroin, the person who's arrested is suffering a great deal and are then being incarcerated for their suffering. And when they get out, it's likely that they'll pick the habit back up because they will be suffering even more, suffering not only from any issues they have related to the drug, but also all the issues of building a life after incarceration. And some of the things that are done in other countries, I think, are based on a really different mentality toward drugs and toward addiction. And that has to do with treating drugs as a public health issue. So thinking about things like not only possession of the drug, but use of the drug and addiction to the drug as either an illness or a condition or a habit that you'd be better off not engaging in. But nevertheless, there are people who will continue doing it. So, for example, in Vancouver, there's a great program that I write about in my book in which it's really a harm reduction program.
Right.
Heroin is actually administered to people who use it by medical professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a person addicted to heroin, you can actually go to this center and have regular doses of heroin administered to you. And throughout that process, they're given information about treatment. Other health issues that they have are addressed. All of these things are done with a mindset toward, well, you'd be better off if you weren't using heroin. But at the same time, the person is given a choice of whether or not they're going to use it. And at the same time, the administration of heroin ensures that while they continue to be dependent on the drug, they're using it safely.
Yes.
As opposed to in the United States where it's illegal and people regularly die from heroin use because they are committing survival crimes in order to get the drug and often using the drug in very unsafe ways, combining it with alcohol, using it after several days of not using it, and then overdosing. So I think that treating it, when you get it out in the open and treat it as a health issue, you're much less likely to be putting people in situations of self-harm.
Wow. Yeah, that's done some interesting research on that. It does, you know, and I just, the laws, you know, we have to look at the laws. Who makes the laws? We elect people as lawmakers. And best of my recollection was the 1970s when politicians, including Tip O'Neill, focused, and really largely led by Tip O'Neill, focused on being tough on crime. You know, three strikes and you're out. Just this very, very simplistic approach to dealing with crime. How much damage has that mantra caused, being tough on crime? And what do you say to those who would say you, Maya Schwenwar, writing about prisons, are being soft on crime? And that, of course, doesn't put politicians in a very flexible position. You know, the idea of decriminalizing heroin, for example. Now, what politician is going to want to touch that? I mean, that's going to be scary. Well, so what do you say to the charge that you are being soft on crime?
Well, I think the first thing is just, what are we talking about when we talk about crime? Are we talking about things that actually harm people? I think that in terms of something like heroin possession or drug possession in general, it's kind of easy to counter that argument because you're saying, well, no, you as a politician or, you know, a prospective politician are advocating a policy that involves spending money on something that won't actually prevent or reduce harm and violence, because this is something that people are doing to harm themselves. And actually, they're more likely to do it if you incarcerate them and traumatize them once they come out. So I think that certainly that argument can be made for something like drug possession. I think, though, that it can also be made for those larger offenses, things that actually are harming people. I think we have to look at those and say, okay, person who says that I'm soft on crime, is your policy actually doing anything to address violence, to address harm that's happening in our society? Is prison really solving those problems? When someone goes to prison after having committed an armed robbery, as you said, Bert, you know, that person goes to prison, interacts with other people who've done the same thing, comes out, doesn't have any money. What are they going to do?
Right. What they know.
Is the policy of incarcerating large numbers of people really being tough on crime, or is it fostering more crime?
Yeah. Interesting point. And the whole idea, you know, when you think about, I don't even like caging animals for that matter. You know, it's like,
it's so,
I don't even want to insult the medieval times, but it strikes me as fairly medieval to, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make sense. But you talk about, and I think this is very, very interesting, and it started to be talked about more and more, harm reduction rather than being tough on crime as a way to begin the necessary change. Are you seeing that discussion getting any traction anywhere in the U.S., the idea of harm reduction? I mean, as you mentioned, Vancouver, that sounds like a good idea. But what about here in these currently United States?
You know, it's interesting because in the United States, there's definitely been a shift in rhetoric around drugs. And, for example, even conservatives will say, well, the drug war has failed.
Right.
We need to end the drug war. What that often means, though, is advocating for maybe more funding for rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And alternative sentencing. So, you know, when someone is convicted of a drug crime, maybe sending them to rehab instead of prison. Well, often that rehab is going to be locked down. That rehab is going to be something that kind of resembles prison.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that that's more of the kind of policy move that's happening in the United States. I think there really isn't enough discussion on the mainstream political level around harm reduction and around the idea that you can't actually incarcerate people into mental health. You can't incarcerate people into recovery.
I laugh because it's so absurd, incarcerating people into mental health, into recovery. It's oh my God, that is rather amazing to think about that and to move the discussion forward. You know, it's tough to do because it's so easy to look tough on crime, but it's extremely expensive. I was just reading a piece in today's New York Times about early intervention. Early intervention, that there is no question, absolutely no disagreement, early intervention, early education, meaning, you know, from pregnancy through age 5 is far more effective at preventing crime. It saves a great deal of money. Why do you think we're not doing more investment on prevention, which clearly saves a lot of money and is much, much more effective at prevention? Is it just it's too hard to see it, whereas now, it's simple. You see a guy commit a crime, you know, rob a local convenience store, you just lock him up. Boom, that's simple.
Right.
Is it politicians still having to look tough?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good point about it being less hard to see. Like, there is something in politics, right, about issues where you need to think a lot about the future versus solutions that just seem like, okay, this is an immediate fix right now. So, for example, it's been very hard to rally political energy around global warming because it's like, oh, climate change, that's happening in the future.
Right.
You know, why would we take action on that?
Right. We need jobs now. You know,
why don't we just drill for oil? That's something we can do right now.
Right, right.
Whereas, so on this issue, it's partially a sense that, well, okay, that's nice, early childhood education, and then maybe people will grow up and we'll have a society with barely any violence. That would be great. But for right now, and then the right now just keeps going for decades. Also, I just think that Americans are very used to thinking punitively, and especially since our society is so infused with racism, and it's just built into the core of the criminal justice system, it's a lot of what's happening in the criminal system is just this kind of social control, you know? So it's, on the one level, we're saying we're tough on crime. On the other level, when whenever that's said, it also functions on this level of racist social control, whereas the message is getting through to maybe powerful white voters and political entities that, yeah, I mean, that's also a way of maintaining white supremacy, if you want to talk about it on those terms.
Well, sure.
So there's all of these things going on, whereas the status quo, as a politician, it's much easier to stick close to that, even when so much money is being wasted. So people are talking in these terms like, oh, we need to be smart on crime, you know, instead of tough on crime. They're shifting the rhetoric, but they're still staying very close to the status quo in terms of what they're actually advocating.
Wow, interesting. And, you know, I had a professor back in college who defined politics as the economy of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And putting people in jail, they have to be taken there, put there, they're held there, there, Lord knows there is violence in jails. I shudder to think about it. But and this is a way, you know, the threat of violence, you don't have to see it every day, but,
right.
You know, this threat of violence and certainly the African-American communities, the, you know, urban centers, they're not unaware of, I mean, it's like the war in Cambodia. It was a secret to Americans, to white Americans, but it was no secret to the people in Cambodia. The same way the racist actions of, you know, sweeping people up and dealing with it that way, they're no surprise to, you know, urban centers and African Americans. And as you write, a high percentage of prisoners are, in fact, people of color, poor and homeless, mentally ill, drug addicted. You contend that by making these people disappear into prisons, we're ignoring larger issues that plague our society. How convenient. By disappearing so many, what are we wanting to pretend doesn't exist, Maya?
Well, I think that what we're pretending doesn't exist are the issues that would actually cause us to shift our way of carrying out politics, which would mean providing early education, providing housing assistance, providing health care, all of these things. We're not as conscious that those needs are so present because we're incarcerating the people who need them most. So by incarcerating huge numbers of poor people and people of color, obviously we're not erasing the entire impoverished population, but we're erasing significant numbers of people who experience the worst poverty, the worst homelessness.
Mm.
We're incarcerating those people, and that's partially hiding the issue from view. So it seems to be not as big of a problem, not only because you can't see the people as much, but also because it seems like we have a tool to deal with it. So it's this very insidious thing, because then those people are, of course, always associated with crime.
Right.
So, for example, in some places now, feeding the homeless is
right.
a crime.
Oh, my God, I know.
Lying down in the subway is a crime. Things that people who are poor and homeless, and particularly people of color and poor people, things that they do are criminalized. So there's this constant sort of rotating cycle of criminalization, incarceration, release, and then rearrest that keeps happening around these populations. Meanwhile, if that's the solution we're using, with solution in quotes,
right.
then we're really obscuring the heart of the problem, which are these issues that we're not providing a good society for most people.
Mm. And again, if you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Maya Shenhar. Her new book is Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. And I think about, I don't know where this line came from, there's, you know, this crime in the suites and then this crime in the streets, you know, and there are subjective judgments made on that. You have people like Henry Kissinger as seen as an elder statesman. You know, crimes against humanity, that seems to me, is a crime. They're, as you mentioned, you know, polluting our environment and getting away with it, having these humongous spills. And yet the people with a lot of money and power and influence, well, that's not a crime. But what, I mean, the message that that gives to, you know, the people we're talking about, the majority of people who are in prison, people of color, poor, homeless, mentally ill, drug addicted. Boy, that's an interesting statement about who we are as a society. And you write that again, the prison system is designed to make the prisoners invisible to the outside world, to, as you write, extinguish the outside world for the men trapped within, and it is largely men. The prison system, quote, deprives the inmates of almost every type of human connection. That's a powerful point, I think. What is the argument in favor of depriving inmates of almost every type of human connection?
Well, I think part of it is about that idea of erasure. You know, that the whole logic around prison is founded on this idea of isolation and confinement and separation. And so I guess the argument for it is actually pretty old. It comes from maybe 200, 150 years ago when prison was first kind of established in its current form. And the idea, of course, this idea didn't work. But the original idea was that prison was kind of a reform.
Right.
That, you know, it used to be more about corporal punishment and capital punishment and physically harming people in order to address wrongdoing that they'd done. And prison came along as, oh, you know, these Christian reformers said, well, if we put people in an isolated situation instead of physically harming them, we'll just leave them alone. They'll many times be in solitary confinement.
Right.
And they'll have to get in touch with God, and they'll have to reckon with what they did. And it kind of almost like the idea of a monastery, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
And that is not actually what happens psychologically to, like, 99.8% of people who are put in solitary confinement. Actually, solitary confinement in many ways is a form of torture.
Yes.
And is recognized that way in many, many different countries besides ours. There is kind of a growing consciousness, I think, here also that solitary confinement is torture. But originally the idea was this, oh, well, you put someone in solitary and they have to reckon with their soul. And now, actually, a lot of those Christian groups that were advocating for prison as a reform are saying, no, we were wrong. This type of confinement doesn't work. And actually, a number of Quakers and other Christian groups that were advocating that way in the 19th century are now saying prison is wrong. We need to abolish prison, and are moving toward different ideas of justice.
Boy, that is such a scary thing for so many people to hear. Abolish prisons.
Right.
Well, it really is, because, you know, the image that comes up is all these bad people, not just people
right.
who have done bad things, but bad people, which is a very big difference, I think. But, you know, all these bad people are just, you know, creeping out and coming into our society. People are afraid of that. And, well, let's get right at what can replace prisons? How can we do it that, you know, best deal with crime more effectively, more humanely, and mainly to protect people who do act well and who don't, you know, commit harm to other people? We need to protect society from people who have done dangerous things. What way can work? What way has worked? Are there examples that you can point
Absolutely,
to?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it needs to happen on a number of levels. I think, for one thing, what you brought up, this idea that we need to take very serious and wide-ranging preventative measures And we need to start early. We need to be funding early childhood education. We need to be funding housing. We need to be providing for people's basic needs. To me, that's kind of a precursor to any idea of prison abolition, is just this understanding that people need to be able to survive and thrive, and that most of the crimes people are committing stem from the conditions that they're living in. And so that's I think, a really crucial element.
Yeah.
I also think that we need to talk about ways of dealing with harm and violence that focus on connection as opposed to this idea of separation and isolation and disconnection.
Oh, interesting.
And in my book, I address a number of projects that are going on that are actually doing that are saying without prison, we can actually address harm and violence more effectively through bringing people together. And that can take a number of forms. One is restorative justice.
Right.
And I give a few different examples of that. I think the most traditional form of restorative justice in many cases is effective. And that's kind of, so let's say harm has been caused. The victim and the perpetrator of the harm are brought together in a circle with members of their community and their families. And they talk and they listen and they hear each other's stories. And the goal is that eventually the victim will be able to find healing in sharing their story, and the perpetrator will be able to understand what they did through hearing how it has affected the victim. And through this process, the idea is that some agreement is reached, some sort of agreement for restitution or reparations, something that the person who has caused harm can do, perhaps over a long period of time, that will serve to actually facilitate the victim's healing and prevent future harm from happening. So, for example, in my book, I discuss a town in Montana where, for all juvenile crime, they use a restorative justice process. And so within that process, let's say a kid has stolen a television, has broken into someone's house and stolen a television. Well, that youth, if the victim's consent, that youth is brought together with the family whose home he broke into. He will have to talk about what he did. He'll have to apologize for what he did. And then the victim and the victim's family, the people whose house was broken into, will have to share, how did this affect them? How did this make their lives difficult? How did it scare them? Can their children sleep at night? Are they now more on edge psychologically as a result? How has it interfered with their day? Are they able to afford a new television at this time? And they talk through this, and the person who's done the harm has to sit there and listen. And actually, that can be very, very difficult, certainly more painful than just never having to deal with the fact that their actions touched anyone, which is what happens in prison. And oftentimes the restitution or the reparations agreement is something that relates to the crime. So in this case, maybe the kid would have to earn the money to pay for a new television for this family and to pay for the damage that he caused in breaking into their house. And maybe he would have to write them a formal apology and regular updates on how he's getting his life on track. And oftentimes, actually, through these arrangements, especially if the victim is responsible for keeping the people posted, filling them in on what he's doing to change his life, often the victims and the people who did harm, develop a relationship. Sometimes even in the case of youth, it's kind of a mentor relationship, you know. It becomes this thing where they're close and they care what happens to the other party. And that has developed a lot, actually, in this town in Montana. Beyond reducing crime, which it has reduced youth crime quite a bit, it has also strengthened the community. It's developed bonds between adults and teenagers that wouldn't have existed otherwise. And stronger communities are one of the key building blocks to a safer and healthier society.
Wow. There's a lot there. And this was Flathead County, Montana. And I understand it was a very Republican, working-class kind of town. Interesting.
Yep. Yeah, very straight-laced. And I think, actually, what prompted their shift toward restorative justice was just an acknowledgement that the system was not working. It was a very practical decision because the youth recidivism rate in Flathead County, it turned out, was the highest in the state. And so they developed this program not because they thought, oh, we want to be nice and, you know, touchy-feely. It was like, wow, this isn't working. Our money is being badly spent, and it's also embarrassing that we have the highest recidivism rate in the state.
And, you know, it's interesting. We talk about these people who go to prison are paying their debt to society. Meanwhile, the victims, this, say that the family that we're talking about whose, you know, TV was they broke in and they stole the TV. I as you describe it, it sounds to me like the family might be able to sleep better knowing that the person actually does get it, that what they did is not okay, that it actually caused harm to people. And it sounds like the restorative justice model may bring a lot more, dare I say, closure to the people, that they don't have to worry as much. If they don't see it, if it's distant, if there's no human connection, how do they know that it isn't going to happen again, at least from this particular individual? Wow.
Right.
Fascinating stuff. The book, again, is called Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. And the author here is Maya Shenhuar. Private prisons. What? That just amazes me. So it seems like, you know, at the same time that there is progress being made with regard to the restorative justice model, there's this whole private prison industry that's going on. Do they really shift costs to inmates and their families? I mean, how bad are these things?
Oh, yeah. And I think that, like, one thing to keep in mind, because corporations have their claws in every prison, and private prisons, I think, represent the worst of that because they're actually profiting off every person in prison, like, very directly. Like, the building is a private entity, and some of these places actually have bed quotas where they're required to fill the beds.
Absolutely.
So it's just, like, directly perpetuating the system. But I will say that the private prison is just the epitome of something that's present in every prison, which is profiting off the family members and loved ones of people who are incarcerated, as well as the incarcerated people themselves.
Oh, my goodness.
One example I give in the book is phone calls. Phone calls from prison are exponentially more expensive than most phone calls on the outside. They charge just exorbitant rates. Some places it's $1 a minute. It's just, and keep in mind that the families of people who are incarcerated very often are poor.
Of course.
And can't afford these exorbitant phone rates. But they're charged almost everywhere, because they can, because they have a monopoly on this market, and they know that the only way that you have to get in touch with your loved one is over the phone. And so it's quite literally a captive market.
Wow.
So that's just one example of the way that corporations are exploiting this phenomenon.
And I have to say, it makes me think of after the alleged abolition of slavery. Well, corporations down south found very convenient ways to reinstitute slavery by throwing people in prison. Very poor
right.
black men, like 100% black men, into prison for minor crimes, and then the corporations would have slaves. And this went on
right.
well into the 20th century.
Right.
What about pretrial incarceration? As you write, there's a great many people who can't afford bail. What about that?
Right.
How long do people spend in pretrial incarceration?
Oh, people spend months and months on end. Sometimes it's over a year. It can be just depending on the trial you're awaiting. Just this horrible injustice. We talk about this idea of being detained without cause as if it's something that only happens at Guantanamo, you know, that like even liberals will discuss it as a military phenomenon, you know, something that the U.S. does to terrorism suspects. But really, this is something that happens all over the country to hundreds of thousands of people. And the only way that you're released is if you can afford to pay your bail. And to me, I mean, this is one of the issues that most deserves addressing immediately. And because we really are incarcerating people for being poor.
Mm.
In many cases, that's the only reason they're being incarcerated. They haven't been convicted of a crime, but they can't pay $300. Most people who are in county jail are incarcerated on bonds that really they could pay under $1,000 and they'd be out. But most people can't pay that. So we're looking at a situation where the people who end up in jail, and again, county jails are worse than prisons in terms of the conditions and the crowding and the resources that are available. You're looking at a situation where the people who are there are the people who are most poor, usually people of color, and don't have the legal connections and resources to be able to get out.
So
I think it really, in many ways, it's just like the extreme of the system as a whole can be found in the county jail.
Oh, great. What about juveniles? Is there still heavy sentencing of juveniles? Do juveniles, people under 18, actually get sentenced to life without parole? And are there signs of progress on this? I mean, that just seems unbelievable to me that young people who do dumb things, instead of, you know, going through the restorative justice process, can get life without parole. What's going on there?
Yeah, it does. It does still happen. And actually, someone who I correspond with in prison, he has been incarcerated since he was 16. He got a life without parole sentence at the age of 16. And it's kind of a tricky situation for him because, juveniles are still allowed in many states to be incarcerated for life without parole. And also, when you've been incarcerated since you're 16 and he now is 36, it feels like a lifetime. You know, he's been incarcerated for more than half his life.
Right.
If he's incarcerated until he's 60, even if it's not his entire life, that's a lifetime. His life has been stolen from him. And that's still permitted. And I think a lot of that actually also can be tied back to race. That in the 80s and 90s especially, there was this myth of the super predator. And it was usually a black teenager, a black teenage male. And the idea was that there was this person roaming around with, like, a lust for blood, this teenager. And there were maybe a couple of cases that were used to highlight there's this person who's coming to get you. And so these policies were instated and these exorbitant sentences were given based on that, based on this image in the media that was never a reality.
And
the public kind of just went along with it. Again, we'd rather not think about people in prison, and the tough on crime mantra is very appealing in terms of getting votes. And so this policy of incarcerating juveniles, it's not really been challenged on the level that you'd think it would be. But as we do it, we see the results, and the results are basically a case of graduation to adult prison.
Right.
And that's what happened with my sister. I never would have seen her as someone who'd end up in prison as an adult, but going to jail as a juvenile paved the way for that. She got out of juvenile detention. She saw herself as someone who was worthless, someone who was a bad kid. She saw herself as a criminal. And she went on to do worse things than she'd done before. She went on to definitely harm herself. She became a heroin addict after being incarcerated. And so I think what we're doing with juvenile detention is really setting people up for a life in which very few possibilities are available to them. And too often that involves reincarceration.
And to think of oneself as a bad person, to me, people do bad things, but to define your identity as worthless and a bad person.
Right.
Oh, my God. That's just, I got to ask you, we don't have a lot of time left, but you talked about in the book, Lockdown, Chicago. Okay, there's a lot of violent crime in Chicago. Wonder if you could tell us about this Austin neighborhood and what beauty salon owners are doing. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I think this is a beautiful story to end on, actually, because Austin is talked about in Chicago. I live in Chicago, and it's always referenced as, like, the violent crime capital of the city, and it has the most incarcerated block in the city, and people are scared to drive through it. But what this woman who organized this program that I write about in the book, she came at it from a few angles. She said, well, you know, characterizing any neighborhood that way is flawed from the start because a neighborhood is composed of people. Yes, Austin is very poor and does experience a high level of violent crime and is rife with a lot of the problems that generate violence, including police violence. But we have to start from the premise that Austin is a community. And so her thought on, well, how do we start addressing violence, was let's look and see what places of healing already exist in our community, and how can we amplify and enhance those places of healing and places of dealing with conflict in ways that aren't violent, that aren't incarceration. How can we amplify those and make a space for an effort to prevent future violence? And the solution she came up with was beauty salons and barbershops, because those were places that youth, especially, but all people really, were going to find solace, to find confidants. Barbers often serve as confidants and people that you discuss your problems with, and especially in Austin, there's a culture of that. And so what she did was she trained barbershop owners and salon owners in restorative justice and in the art of the listening circle. coming together, listening to each other, talking, and making these places, these barbershops and beauty salons, places where people could naturally go, not only to talk about their problems with their barbers, but also in a situation of violence, this is a place that the victim and the perpetrator could come to have a circle and talk about what harm was done and how they might move past it. And so far, the results have been really promising. I think that the ways that it's been most interesting are the ways that it's played out kind of on an everyday level, not just convening circles, but also once barbers are given these strategies for addressing harm and conflict, when someone is talking to them about, this guy is messing with my sister, I'm going to beat him up, They can say, okay, well, let's think about, like, what's going on in this situation? Like, what's the problem? What are you angry about? What are some possible ways that you could deal with this besides resorting to violence? Thinking through options kind of just on the conversational level as these issues come up. And I just think that's such a great way to start addressing these issues in a natural setting, as opposed to like, okay, let's set up something at the police department where we would do restorative justice. No, why not start here? Why not start in a place where people are already raising their issues, raising their concerns, and talking about conflict in a way that feels comfortable to them?
Fascinating, fascinating, and rather optimistic. It's good to know that there are other solutions out there. Very interesting and, dare I say, important book here, Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. It's put out by BK Currents Publishing. Maya Shenwar, thanks so much. Very, very informative discussion. Thanks for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show.
Well, thank you so much. This is great.
Thanks.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blow. Dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I've bound. No one could change my mind, but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild. Mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, for the bad I kept on turning. Raise me better, but I plead and I deny that these only